Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. My guest today is OBGYN, Dr. Nathan Riley. As a young OBGYN, he has made the transition from the medical model that most other doctors are practicing in to supporting midwives and home births. He's got a midwife collaboration program, he's got a born-free method, a holistic approach to HPV and preventing cancer. And the shocking thing to me was when C-section rates in hospitals are running 30 to 40%, he still deals with high-risk pregnancies and has a home birth C-section rate of less than 5%. It's crazy impressive. Now, the ending, Dee Dee Hoover does a masterful job of playing devil's advocate and then getting into some really controversial topics. You're not going to want to miss it. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My topic today is gratitude, but it's a specific gratitude. I want to thank all of you who are speaking truth to power. Thank you for those of you who are standing up for people who have no sense of power, who have no hope. You know, so many of you are risking your careers, even relationships, to do what's right, and we need more of that. So I applaud and encourage all of us to stand for what we know needs to be done in our world today. You know, peaceful disobedience, sometimes it's necessary. And I think it's important, especially in everything we've seen happen in the last few years. So I am in gratitude to all of you. We need to continue to have compassion for people who feel differently, people who disagree with us, people who maybe are even what we would consider our enemies. But let's lead with love. We certainly have endless opportunities for forgiveness, but I feel a shift is coming. So let's stay strong in what we're doing. Welcome, Dr. Nathan Riley. It is such a privilege to have you back on the show.
Dr. Thomas, it's always a pleasure to meet another person who's not just out there like self-promoting, but is actually reading literature and still in helping to try to navigate this whole informed consent thing. Like, it's really, I feel so refreshed just having spent some time with you earlier today. It's just, it's an honor. So I'm happy that we get to spend more time together.
Yeah, the feeling's mutual. You are a rare indeed breed of an OBGYN. You're board certified in that specialty, which is the group of doctors who take care of pregnant women, right? And female issues. You're a co-creator of the Born Free method and Clear and Free, your holistic solution to persistent HPV, which we're going to talk about before we're done. Yeah. But I wanted to start with, because not everybody necessarily knows your story, how the heck does a OBGYN get disillusioned with traditional care and start doing all these incredible, innovative things you're doing? What's your journey there?
I probably get a different answer to this all the time. And I don't want to be disparaging to people who are still inclined to go to the hospitals and clinics. But for me personally, as a man, as like a lifelong student, I just found I wasn't getting support from people that were training me or that my colleagues and whatnot for just asking questions and wanting to investigate those answers and being willing to be wrong. Nobody really out there likes being wrong. I've been wrong about like 90% of the things that I've conjectured, but I've also been right about 10%. And those 10% have not only gotten me in trouble, but they've also been the sort of seeds that have grown into these really extraordinary conversations I've had with people who have felt let down by the system. So I'm serving a minority, but that minority is really, I think, growing and blossoming into a large minority and perhaps will eventually be the majority. And that really, in summary, is people that I think have become disillusioned with this sort of illusion of safety that's been offered by the medical establishment, the medical industrial complex. And I still think there's good reasons to go to the hospital and sometimes get C-sections and whatnot, but like a lot of people are being broken by that system. So I didn't take an oath to perpetuate a broken system. I took an oath to take care of people, and that's what I do now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when you went to medical school, did you have any idea your career would take this trajectory?
Hell no. I thought I'd have a 401k and I'd be making several hundred thousand dollars per year and driving an Audi and whatnot. And granted, I'm not like hurting financially, but I don't live in California where the cost of living is extraordinarily high. I live in Kentucky. And We have two little girls. The second was born at home. And I work with midwives now. Wow. I'm like a student of midwifery now. So yeah, I did not think that's where my career was going to go. That's for sure.
That is just amazing. And so you're in your, let's just go back to, you're in your OBGYN residency. I remember rubbing elbows with the OBGYN residents because as a pediatrician, we're in the delivery. You guys are cutting the babies out and handing them off to us. Yep. And we're drying them off and occasionally giving them oxygen, whatever we had to do. The system that we were trained in was all we knew. How did you end up waking up to the fact that maybe there's a better way or a different way that seems to have, what kind of health outcomes are you seeing?
It's pretty simple. I started listening. Started listening to people and women who had, let's say, I'll go back to my medical school training. I had a really great attending. I did an OB anesthesiology rotation for whatever reason. And I think part of it was like, oh, maybe I want to place epidurals and spinals. There are, in certain parts of the world, OBGYNs can do that. You have the skills to do it. You just haven't trained to do it. So let me go in and do that. And I realized, man, these are like the ultimate customer service agents. And there was an attending I had who's remained good friends of mine. She now has a trauma-informed, completely free prenatal practice up in Pittsburgh. Her name's Tracy Vogel, and she still works as an OB anesthesiologist. But she shared so many stories with me when I was rotating with her about women who had like natural physiologic births, what you're thinking of, what people listening are thinking of, and they still felt like something wasn't right. And I found that to be so interesting. It was like, what could you possibly complain about? You have a healthy mom, healthy baby. And when you start to unpack that, you realize the way that we speak to people, the way that we honor the experience, that is actually everything. And as a now father, I realize that the way that a doctor speaks to me or touches my daughter or makes me feel like they're actually seeing me as a person, I am not a dumb guy. I'm not the smartest guy, but I'm not like a total idiot either. The way that they spoke to me, the way that they made me feel seen and heard was actually everything. And I realized that women in the hospital system giving birth were not feeling seen. They were not feeling like they were being given a real fair shake at informed consent. They were having information withheld so that they could stay on the medical train and the doctors and the nurses and whoever, all good people with good intentions, could continue doing things the way that they were doing it. Oftentimes, I think at the cost of a person's fully embodied birth experience, which I don't see as a medical procedure. I see it as a very sacred transformation. I've gone through the birth of my own children. That is a really intensely exciting and also oftentimes very scary experience. I didn't feel like I was prepared with those tools. And by listening to women and their partners and their families, I realized I got to do things differently because I can't continue to do it this way. Even though the stats would tell you it's safe and all this other stuff, they're saying I didn't feel safe. So what is that? Unpacking that and listening to people is really, I think, where I started getting nudged out. I saw myself out. It was like, maybe I just don't belong here.
So then, how long have you been doing home births or supporting midwives who are doing home births?
Been about 5 years now. Only four years, actually. I practiced in Encinitas and down at Scripps while I was in fellowship for hospice and palliative care. I'm actually dual board certified. And while I was in hospice fellowship training, I was working as a full-time OBGYN in a Scripps hospital doing all of the stuff as a hospitalist, meaning I was there to do all the emergency things whenever their doctors weren't available to come in. Mm. And it was a really great place. Lots of C-sections, lots of like really emergency kind of stuff. And then when I got recruited out to Kentucky, it was about 6 months into my tenure there. And I was like, I can't do this. There's people calling me in to help with C-sections and they want to talk about their kids' basketball games and they want to do all this stuff. And I'm like, this is a person who's going through the most nightmarish thing of their life, an emergency C-section. We're just going to like casually just dabble about whatever small talk. So I called it quits there and immediately found myself in a space where I could either start a home birth practice myself, or if I really believe in midwifery, I could support midwives. And that's when I started collaborating with midwives around the country. And then that led me naturally into home birth because there's a lot of midwives who can't practice based on licensing restrictions and whatnot. They can't see certain people. And then those people, their only option is to go to the hospital. If we can pay attention to certain things and we can dial in your lifestyle, maybe detox before your pregnancy, all those types of things, you don't have to worry about those pregnancy complications. but nobody's doing that work. So I found myself in this kind of strange niche, taking care of high-risk people from their past pregnancies and helping them have their dream births in their current pregnancy.
Wow. You've probably helped hundreds already?
Yeah, it was like 1,000+ births when I finished my year down in Encinitas. And now, yeah. if you were to take the births I've gone to myself and the number of women I've supported in pregnancy by means of supporting their midwife, it's probably been thousands. It's the most rewarding sort of path I could have found myself on.
You are a blessing to the whole birth industry.
Yeah.
It takes real guts to have the extensive training that you've had.
Yeah.
And I would also add maybe indoctrination.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
To then be able to break away and support midwives. What a blessing. I remember when my mom was a nurse midwife in the Ohio Valley, and she was training. She was a certified nurse midwife from Yale, training lay midwives so that they would recognize high-risk situations.
Wow. Cool.
And they could not find OBGYNs to support them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a national growing problem nationally. There's a lot of states where midwives, they could have attended 10,000 births. They cannot practice midwifery without a quote collaborative physician or a supervising physician, as if I, this like young guy who trained in the medical system, has any real insights into what's going on in out of hospital birth. This is apples and oranges. Fortunately, I straddle those two worlds, and I've been able to support midwives and keep them in practice and not make the money. I'm not charging the home birth fees that a lot of people do. When I do go to home births, yeah, there's a fee there, but instead of hiring me, let me just support your midwife so they can then take care of 10 of you at one time. So it was more of, it's not selfless. It's more just, listen, if we want to have the most impact, who is doing the best birth work? It's midwives.
Yeah.
So let's put our resources towards that. I'd like the whole country to do that. But for now, I'm like an N of one who's supporting midwives in now 24 states. I've got 24 medical licenses. It's a lot.
Yeah. So I know your website's belovedholistics.com, and they can click on a link there for midwife collaboration program. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and of course, your podcast, right. Which I was just on your podcast. It's an amazing podcast.
Thank you.
In fact, I had an interesting question. I didn't warn you about this one, but it just popped in my head. Having been on your podcast, what have you learned from others in your podcast that just stand out? Wow.
No, the joy of having a podcast is I can bring in people that are relative. I don't know what the word expert means anymore, but there are people that have been so deeply thoughtful and committed to trying to understand certain things about the human experience that is so relevant to birth work. For example, like intimacy between, let's just look at like a male and a female, like a heterosexual relationship. The opportunity that men are seeking now to be a part of this experience, to really show up in a very different form of masculinity compared to what our fathers, our brothers, our fraternity brothers, whatever was modeled to us, that doesn't really serve us nowadays if you want to be fully invested in this birth process. I get the opportunity to bring people on that are experts in Tantra. They're experts in the sort of work of David Data of divine masculinity, divine femininity. It really helps to put together the whole story of the human experience as opposed to looking at ourselves as this automated, robotic kind of automobile. The greatest insights that I've gained are actually things that I've, like John Wineland was a guest recently, and I read his book, and like my sex life with my wife started getting better. Like these little bits of information that are less about this sort of linear process of what you do in life and more about actually embracing presence and community and connection with the people we love the most, including my own little girls. It's a joy to have a podcast like that. You can just have these conversations where I'm like genuinely curious, and then we can unpack it in conversational kind of a flow. That's, I think that's probably the greatest insights that I've gained from guests on my podcast.
Wow. Thank you.
What about you? I'm curious.
Sure, I can go there. Let me finish this thought though.
Okay.
So I was visiting with my daughter just this last week, and she's 8 months pregnant, and she's going to do a home birth, and she has a midwife support, but that's it. She doesn't have you in the background. So I'm really glad to know about you, and I'm going to tell her about you. But
give her my number.
I was having this conversation with her husband, and he made the comment, this childbirth at home stuff, I'm just going to be in the background. I'll bring the hot water and I'll serve coffee. And then I'm listening to your description of being in touch with your soul and the purpose of connecting and all of that.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, I need to send him to your podcast.
I do as much counseling of soon to be fathers as I do pregnant women nowadays, because listen, the pregnancy thing is actually the easy part. What's going to come for the next 18 years raising this little child? That's really that's the hard part of having a baby, I think.
Absolutely. And navigating all these tough decisions, which I know both of us handle on our podcast. So to flip it back on myself, you're asking me what I've learned. I'll say for COVID especially, because I was pretty versed in pediatrics. That was my wheelhouse. Yeah. And then comes COVID. What the heck is this? Yeah. First of all, it just descends upon us and we're all like scrambling to try to figure it out. And I've since had countless amazing people, Peter McCullough, Pierre Corey, and countless others who are really on the cutting edge of not only did they figure it out, but they're speaking up, standing strong when they're being censored.
And who else is going to give them that platform? Like nowadays, the media at large is not really interested in those conversations, but we get to just do this and get to learn from one another. And at the end of the day, you're just a person. I'm just a person. Yeah. And every single day, I have to figure out, where do I put my attention? Oh, Paul Thomas was just on my podcast and he said something that stuck with me. And that's like a different path for me to go down. That's really, I think, how we're going to evolve medicine. That's how we're going to really move our society in the right direction, is having honest conversations with people that are willing to just say, I don't know, what do you think? That's really, I think, that's what drew me into medicine in the first place, is having that collegiality. I don't have that in my life right now, so.
It's so true. I'm really grateful for your podcast. I imagine you've covered COVID and masks a bit on your show.
Oh, yeah. James Thorpe, who's an OBGYN MFM in Florida, he was on the podcast recently. Yeah, all of those things have actually become a big part of, unfortunately, has become a sort of the forefront of my whole practice. Because let's take the farm, for example, Ina May's sort of legacy in Summertown, Tennessee. The farm midwifery practice used to attract people from around the world to have a really unusual birth experience on this farm, this commune in Tennessee. But then COVID happened and midwives shit the bed more than anybody. Suddenly they like succumbed to this fear, and now you had to have a mask on and you had to be double or triple boosted and all this stuff. And I'm speaking as a peripheral observer.
Right.
Some of these birth centers that were radically different, they just succumbed to this notion that you have to have a mask on while you're giving birth and all this. And a lot of women were like, no, my wife included, we're having a home birth because I'm not wearing a mask and pushing my baby out. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to have you shove a stick up my nose while I'm actively laboring. Like, it's just not going to happen. So yeah, we've had a lot of conversations like that.
And your observation, since you've been open-minded about the fact that maybe those masks weren't really doing much, you've probably had plenty of exposure the last 2-3 years of home childbirths done unmasked. And how did it go? Were they putting themselves at risk?
I think that there's two elements to this. And we talked a little bit about this on my podcast when you were on recently. The first is that people who succumb to this fear and that there's some sort of external device that's going to save them, they actually end up using that as a surrogate for living healthy lives. Mm. The people that are walking around with no vaccines, no masks, and they're not getting sick, their family's not getting sick and whatnot, it's because they're actually probably living a healthy life. But the second part of it is that as soon as you succumb to fear, you're going to show up in a way, in childbirth or otherwise, that reflects a world that is scary, that you're going to get hurt and all that. Like, that becomes your reality. Like, your world does become scarier. And we could talk about the neurochemistry of fear and how it suppresses the immune system and polyvagal theory and all of this. But truthfully, the people that are birthing with me and a lot of my colleagues, including Sarah Rosser, who's one of the most incredible midwives I've ever worked with, they're healthy people and they're just not willing to play the whole fear game. They're like, yeah, this is an exciting thing and I'm not going to go through this already very exciting thing, this sometimes scary thing, childbirth, and simultaneously be afraid I'm going to get sick or whatever else. I'm just not going to play into that. And that actually, I think, is reflected in some of our statistics and Milo's C-section rates and everything else. Fear is pickle.
Yeah. Actually, you've got to share your C-section rate because I learned it on when I was on your podcast. But you are dealing actually with a lot of high-risk pregnancies in the sense that they've had other problems in the past with past pregnancies that almost any other OBGYN would say is a requirement to deliver in the hospital.
Yeah.
And yet you're supporting people to have these subsequent births at home. And what's your C-section rate been?
It's 4 to 5% consistently.
Wow.
Consistently. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they are not low risk. These are higher risk women.
Yeah. Yeah. That blows my mind because there are big downsides to having a C-section for both the baby and the mom.
Yeah.
And so instead of a 30, 40% C-section rate, had these high risk pregnancies gone to the hospital, you're at less than 5%. That's what a gift you're giving these families. And sure, I'm some of those 5% that end up in the hospital. I imagine it's a bit of a scramble, but I'm sure that you have a contingency plan so they do okay.
A big part of it is setting some very clear expectations, right? Listen, I can't promise anything. I'm not going to guarantee anything. In fact, even a baby that comes by C-section in the hospital, healthy mom, healthy baby means nothing to me. Because like you said, our composite scores generally don't take into account the non-measurable things, the mental, emotional, even spiritual aspects of this process, which is why when I was telling you that in the hospital, just having a breathing and living baby afterwards is not everything for people. But also, we do so much preparation way in advance, even before they get pregnant. We look at phase one and phase two metabolism in the liver. Have we detoxified from you, from all this other junk? Are you eating organic food? Are you eating nutritious foods? Are you moving adequately? Are you hydrating well with living water, not like crappy water from your sink? Are you sleeping well? Are your adrenals in order? Like, how is your emotional boundaries? We get all of that in order. And it's no surprise then that they have a lower risk of these pregnancy complications arising in subsequent pregnancies. It's what can we do to avoid those things that you've been told are inevitable? And it turns out there's a lot in people's control. And I don't think a lot of doctors are trained on how to do a variety of those things. So I have this kind of magic combination of things that gets people to where they want to go.
Yeah. I imagine this is incorporated in your born free method.
This is the whole thing. Yeah. I don't have enough time in my days to take everybody one-on-one. So I say, join the community, born free method. It teaches you everything, including vaccines and ultrasounds and all these other things that are controversial or at least growing in controversy for some people. We cover everything, including all the lifestyle stuff that you can use right now to avoid that. And I become like your concierge guy, but I can't do it one-on-one with every single person who comes to me. So we built the program and it's going really well. So
fantastic. Thank you for doing that. That's the direction I'm going as well. We need to reach more people. So
it's absolutely
really great that you've done that. Let's pivot a little bit to your HPV program. You've got a free holistic solution to persistent HPV. And I think you have some pretty strong thoughts about cancer screening and prevention and mitigation of abnormal results. What can you share?
So we've got about 14 million per year, people per year diagnosed with HPV in our country alone. About 80 million people are living with it. So let's pause there. Those are big numbers, right? The issue, though, that I have with it is, number one, viruses are not living things. They're not out to get us. All these vaccines that you and I have shot the breeze over, do you really need to be vaccinated against every possible virus? Probably not. I think most people are going to do just fine. And if you're not doing just fine, like human papillomavirus, a little tiny strand of DNA just floating around in a viral protein capsule, if you get that and your body is not able to kick it, or what I say is integrate it, then there's a signal there. What is the signal? There's something going on with your immune system. And furthermore, your immune system is also responsible through NK cells and other T cells to scavenge precancerous cells. You and I both have cancer cells, but we have a strong immune system that goes around and says, nope, you're not, you don't belong. Nope, you don't belong. The macrophages spit them out and you're fine. What happens to the OBGYN clinics, that this is what I was trained to do, was that people arrive, they get their routine pap smear, something's abnormal, or the HPV screen is positive, it's abnormal. So you end up coming back in 6 to 12 months, and we're hoping and praying that it's not abnormal anymore. The OBGYNs are not giving women, or their partners for that matter, any tools in order to take this signal as an opportunity to get something in their lifestyle better in order. So in that 6 to 12 months, by the way, Paul, HPV transmission to abnormal cells showing up, months to years. And then from that, what we call cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, SIN, when that progresses, for it to progress to invasive cancer, years to decades. And yet nobody in these clinics, in these multiple visits, the biopsies, the excisional procedures, nobody's giving you any tools in order to help get whatever's upstream back in order so that this is not an issue for you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Boost the immune system.
Just boost the immune system,
detox,
right?
Detox and boost the immune system.
Yeah. But what your OBGYN will offer you, instead of telling you, hey, listen, it's a 90% chance this is going to go away on its own, and we can boost that dramatically, almost to 100%. I'm not going to say 100% because that's not fair, but almost not 100% if we can get your diet, your movement, your sleep, and all those things in order. So even if you do develop abnormal cells, that SIN3, that's the next step before invasive cancer, 50% is going to regress on its own. So all we have to do is say, okay, listen, there is a risk here, but what can we do? What's in your control? The OBGYNs, the nurse practitioners, the midwives aren't doing that. So now I have to do that. It's another thing that it's, geez, oh man, now I have to do this, take this whole approach like I did with pregnancy and childbirth, and I have to do the unpopular thing. But women are clearing HPV. They're clearing their cervical dysplasia. And it's not rocket science. It's just very basic things.
Yeah, that's exciting. I remember reading a paper some years back on HPV vaccine. It was in JAMA and it was claiming that it was reducing cancer. And as I read through the data carefully, the rates of SIN3, which is the most closest to actual cancer, had gone up in the vaccinated.
Let's talk about it.
But the abstract and the title suggested that the HPV vaccine was reducing your risk. So what's your take on the HPV vaccine at this point?
So what you just described was negative efficacy. Let's get, we'll get there in 60 seconds. Let's first start by looking at our favorite pharmaceutical company, Merck, who in the early 2000s was facing tens of millions of dollars in lawsuits due to Vioxx. Vioxx was causing heart attacks. It's an NSAID like ibuprofen. It was causing all these issues. They were hit with tons of lawsuits. They were going to go bankrupt. They threw a Hail Mary and created an entire PR campaign around preventing cervical cancer. And they launched their Gardasil vaccine, which is now called Gardasil 9. There are three variations of cervical cancer vaccines, if you want to call them that. The third, Gardasil 9, is currently the only one available on the market in the United States. It was advertised through the Be One Less campaign. This is in the early 2000s. I think 2006 is when Gardasil 9 was released, if I recall. It was advertised as a means of preventing cervical cancer. The problem is, for the reasons I mentioned, cervical cancer takes years to decades to develop. So we can't measure that as the primary endpoint in our studies. So what they did was, using some less than honest placebo-controlled trials, I'm using air quotes on my end, is that they used SIN2 and SIN3 as the surrogate markers, because those can progress to cervical cancer, even though a big portion of those will regress on their own, even without my help. The problem here is that it had been, parents had become so conditioned through this Be One Less campaign to think that they were being irresponsible for not vaccinating their children, which, by the way, this is offered as early as age 9, before you become sexually active, to boys and girls. My little girls are going to be offered this as well as a means of preventing cervical cancer, but it was never demonstrated to prevent cervical cancer. And when you've been exposed to the high-risk strains of HPV, 16 and 18 in particular, and you get the vaccine, they saw that these women were more likely to develop SIN2 and SIN3 after they had been, after the vaccine had been administered, once they'd already been exposed to 16 and 18. So one way to look at that is the vaccine caused the cancer. I do think that vaccines certainly dysregulate the immune system. I don't think it's fair to say it caused it any more than cigarettes cause cancer or lung cancer, because not everybody who smokes gets lung cancer. Not everybody who got this vaccine got cervical cancer, but there's definitely something there to explore. And the unwillingness of our medical system to explore this and ask the questions is what has led so many women to feel completely powerless, and really not just powerless, but they're succumbing to this fear that once they get that positive HPV screen, that it's doomsday around the corner. And that's just simply not the case.
Yeah. So you might have answered this and I missed it, but what do you tell those women who've gotten the HPV vaccine and now they're worried? Are Is there something they can do?
Similarly to all the hepatitis B, for example, like all these other vaccines that we're giving kids, I say, great, you got the vaccine. I don't really care if you got the vaccine. I don't think that it protects you. I don't think it's necessarily in isolation outside of the 72-dose vaccine schedule. I don't think in isolation, it's the end of the world. Plus, we can't unvaccinate you. So let's let the, you know, bygones be bygones. Let's worry about everything that is in your power in order to make sure that your immune system, your nervous system, your endocrine systems, all those systems are working in your biodynamic being in order to make sure that you're not predisposed to some serious infection or consequence to that infection in the future. And this goes for coronavirus, the flu, anything. Like there's no reason, Paul, for us to be afraid of viruses. They outnumber bacteria 10 to 1 at least in nature. So if viruses are out to get us, we're all doomed because they're everywhere. They're all over us. So what can we do if we're not looking at diet and our clean water, air, and soil? If we're not sleeping well, if we're not setting emotional boundaries, not managing stress, yeah, you could get sick and die from a viral infection. That's a real shame because we've got so much money and resources in our country. And the best the OBGYNs can do is say, uh-oh, come back in 6 to 12 months, we'll repeat the screen. And hey, if it's still positive, we might need to take a painful biopsy. No anesthesia for that. That's the colposcopy with biopsy. And ooh, then if you end up with an excisional procedure, we're lopping the top of your cervix off. There's all sorts of issues with that. That's an erogenous zone. That's one of your sexual organs. It has pregnancy implications, all sorts of things. So my whole thing is, listen, don't be afraid. What is in your control? Let's work on those things that are in your control.
Wow. I was going to ask you, what is the most important thing you want people to remember? I think you just answered it.
That's it right there.
This is amazing. So people can reach you at, find you at belovedholistics.com. You can /podcast to get to the podcast. You can click on the midwifery collaboration program, your born free method, this HPV information. Impressive. Don't leave, folks. I'm going to have Dede Hoover talk with Dr. Nathan Riley on a personal level. She has that knack for just getting real. You guys have fun.
Can't wait. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan, for joining me and being willing to be put through the Dede interview.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to tell you, I was listening to your episode that you did with Dr. Paul on your show, and you played devil's advocate, and then he played devil's advocate. You folks are terrible about at devil's advocate. So let me show you how devil's advocate is supposed to be played. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. Dr. Riley, it is so much better for the baby to get vaccinated through the mom. And because if that way, if the mom catches these diseases, then the baby is protected. Also, what if the mom were to get, or if the mom catches the diseases, not only the baby protected, but the mom's protected? Because I'm serious. Think about this, Dr. Riley. If mom were to get polio when she's pregnant with the baby, she could die and then the baby would die. Do you understand that? Why do you not recommend shots during pregnancy? I think that's insane that you don't. That's how you play devil's advocate, by the way.
That's good. That's nice. I like that. You set me up. That's a softball, though. You got to, we're playing in the big leagues. And I'm just kidding.
Actually, I think that's pretty big league with what's going on in the world.
Yeah, no.
Okay, how about COVID? I should have said COVID, dang it.
I want to reiterate this whole fear around viruses, right? Most of the things that we're vaccinating against, that we're trying to get an immune response towards to protect us, are against viruses, which outnumber bacteria 10 to 1. If viruses are the bad guys, then we are doomed. There's no amount of vaccines that are going to protect us because the coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2, that big name, SARS-CoV-2, reflects a specific strain of coronavirus, which is why flu vaccines don't work that well, which is why the COVID shots aren't going to work that well. And so if we're thinking about vaccinating a pregnant woman and we're really concerned about her health, if that's our motivation, why aren't we doing more in order to support their health through systemic change, radical reform in how we feed ourselves, the available nutritious food? If we're really concerned about viral infection and viruses are going to win, if they're bad guys, they are always going to win. the inability for us to just take the information from this little nucleic acid strip, this little microscopic, like electromicroscopic, like these are little fragments of stuff. If that's the big concern, why aren't we investing as much as we can into helping pregnant women be as healthy as possible from the moment that they get that positive pregnancy test? That's my actual
answer. I think even before that, I think that's the point of anybody, if you're, and we talk about that with our nutritional stuff. But what I want you to explain to a lot of people now, right now, is tell me why are these shots dangerous during pregnancy?
I don't think that they're resulting in a healthier immune response. So it's not so much that I don't believe that the technology is beautiful and elegant and important. I think it's really awesome that we have this idea. But what we're injecting is not just promoting an immune response against a scary pertussis or whatever else. It's also putting in a bunch of toxic stuff into a pregnant woman. And it's, I think, perpetuating fear, which is going to do you no good as you approach pregnancy or childbirth.
Right. But if you get this shot, devil's advocate, if the mom is getting the shot, why would it affect the baby?
Why would it? Because everything that mom is being exposed to is going to the baby. So when I talk about what type of food you're eating, it's the same conversation as what's going into your body through injectables. You could make the same argument around a variety of other injectable things. Like vitamin K is a great example. That's in the baby, of course. But what are we really trying to do with this? And is the benefit outweighing the harm? I don't really think that we
have data. No, don't get to that one yet. We have that one upcoming.
Okay. So whatever you're putting into the mom is going to the baby. And these babies, you could look at it through epigenetics. You could look at it through a variety of other factors. Okay. Whatever is going into your body, whether it's injected or it's consumed orally or put on your skin or it's in your cookware or whatever else, it's going to the baby. We got to treat our babies, our wombs, like temples. And that's just that. That's just that.
No, you're right. Okay. Unvaxxed kids get sick anyway, right? If not vaccinating is because vaccines make kids sick, then what's the point? Especially when vaccines protect against so many deadly diseases. As an OBGYN, here's an opportunity as soon as your baby is born to do the vitamin K shot, to do Hep B. These are all things that can keep these children from dying. And the vitamin K shot, come on, you don't want your baby to bleed to death. So why are you, as an OBGYN, not recommending those things? Don't you feel like that's unsafe?
I am first and foremost a pretty analytical guy. And when I consider if we're going to go down the path of, I think vitamin K is a really great example, because now this is super universal. And I talked to Dr. Paul about my experience in residency about hepatitis B, and then later looking at the safety data myself and being like, oh my God, I was right. That's so validating. And I can't believe that we're doing this universally. Vitamin K is a great example. It's not technically a vaccine, but it is injected into the baby. And there's a number of issues there. So the risk of hemolytic disease of the newborn in the developed world, like rich countries like the United States, is somewhere in the range of 9 in 100,000. It is extremely low. So if we're promoting the idea that the baby can't stop from bleeding inside the brain without this injectable thing, we have to then consider the harms. What is the harm? Moments after the baby comes out of the uterus, already in a cacophony of noise and lights, and just, it's a scary place, right? A lot of people are wearing masks now, and this little baby was just in this warm amniotic universe, and now you're going to inflict pain in the heel. All because there's a risk of 9 in 100,000. So my analytical mind says, listen, to the person who's coming to me to help, the risk of this bad thing happening is 9 in 100,000. We can decrease that risk by injecting your baby with this. But potentially there's a harm there, because we're telling the baby as soon as they arrive Earthside that it's an unsafe place. It's a painful place to be Earthside. So I don't even really care about the potential benefits, because the benefit there is extremely small. So even from an analytical standpoint, our risk is very low of this bad thing happening. So the benefit is very low of the presumed, whatever, mechanism of action of vitamin K. And there's a whole bunch of other things that are very hard to measure, but that we know are important, because we listen to women, we listen to their partners, we listen to the babies. Right. And if it's not If there's not a great benefit, then I need better evidence. The burden of evidence, I think, is on those people who want to deviate from nature. And there's nothing natural about shooting synthetic vitamin K into a baby's foot.
Right. What do you think? I'm going to ask you just because it is something that we have recommended in the past, and that's the drops, the vitamin K, isn't that what it is? Vitamin K drops. And orally, because I think the thing that's risky for these moms is that they're told, especially with a C-section baby, man, they're so risked. The babies are being, they could have bleeding because of how violent the birth is or coming down the birth canal and all the different things that could cause the bleeding. So it puts, again, a state of fear in a mom that, especially with a C-section baby, that could be an issue. And so the drops is this way of saying, okay, maybe if there's an issue, then that's there. Do you support drops or do you say no vitamin K at all?
I don't have any. So my approach is not to say do this or don't do this. It's to say, hey, listen, here is what we know from the data. I am not opposed to people wanting to get vitamin K as long as they're informed. The drops are an alternative. We did that for our first. We did not do anything for our second. But what I will also say is that, again, back to what I said before, do you think it's impossible to conceive of a healthy diet in a pre-pregnancy and during pregnancy, this woman eating vitamin K2 rich foods, that it's not going to somehow be translated into a baby that has healthy blood and healthy clotting? Of course not. The same goes, this is a fat soluble vitamin. The same goes for breastfeeding. If you have a natural birth, you're eating nutritious foods. And by the way, those would be bone broth, organ meats, fermented cod liver oil, smoked oysters, eggs. If you're taking those five foods, you are going to have absolutely zero issues related to micronutrient deficiencies.
I'm glad no one told me about those foods when I was pregnant because I probably could have done it, but I would have thrown up every time after. I'm just kidding. I agree.
It's an acquired taste.
Yes, it is. And again, there's so many things that we do. We want to have healthy babies. So I'm glad you said those things. Here's another one. I heard you say, Dr. Nathan, that your second child that's unvaccinated and had nothing interrupted to that precious little body actually is getting more sick more often than your first child who had vaccinations. So if that's the point, should you have vaccinated your child then? And maybe that's because your wife didn't get any shots during her pregnancy. Is that why?
No, Dr. Paul actually helped me with this one. I had asked him about this before the recording, and he was like, your toddler is going to preschool and out and about and bringing home all the germs in order for the second little one now to just be exposed to more things at a more rapid rate. And I'll add that so we were never leaving the house, and now our little one is out and about and just getting exposed to a lot more. So I actually feel very grateful that Paul told me that, because now I'm like, great, she's going to have a super immune system in a year. She's healthy. She's fine. It's just, she's just getting more sniffles than I expected. But I told him, I was like, man, is this like, it seems counterintuitive. He was like, no, like it's just your baby's getting exposed to more things. Okay, no problem.
Which we're finding is good just simply too, because, and I always ask parents when they say that with their toddlers that did, or kids who did get vaccinated, they get sicker when they're sick, and theirs will last longer. And part of it is not having that immune system that built up. So what you'll notice is when your second baby is a toddler, they probably won't have some of those same illnesses. But that's funny that you even are like, okay, so I'm done playing devil's advocate. Here we go. If you could go back knowing what you know now, what would you do differently regarding education and career? Would you be a midwife?
No, I'd be in the Forest Service or something. I'd be like a conservation. Myself in a space now where I feel obligated to continue doing what I'm doing. Good. But I had no idea that I was going to be so indoctrinated. Like, I thought that this was the ultimate foray into the curiosities of the medical sciences. And I've been very much forced pigeonholed into do it this way or else. And I told Dr. Paul when he was on my podcast recently, like, I've been a challenging kid probably since kindergarten. In fact, they wanted to hold me back in kindergarten because I didn't want to do what the other kids were doing, and they thought I was slow. And I was just like, this is too easy. I need to do something else. I've been a problem child, I think, for most of my life.
Well, that's funny. I wonder if that's why my sister was held back. I got to skip kindergarten. I guess it's because I was sweet.
Yeah, I wasn't.
So honestly, would you, if you could do it again and again, have that knowledge, would you completely not do a medical career?
It's hard to say that. Everything I said there is a little tongue in cheek. I feel like I'm doing so much good in the world now that I've actually changed my tone when med students or pre-med students reach out and they're asking me about my careers and whatnot. I've spoken at high school career fairs and whatnot. I actually don't tell people to not go into medicine. I just hope that people who do go into medicine are able to maintain their identity and their sense of curiosity, which has really helped me flourish as a man, as a father, as a husband, as a physician. If I were told that the only way you could be an OBGYN is to work in the system that is perpetuating so much obstetric violence and whatnot, if that were the only way forward, then I would say, hell no, this was not for me. But I have found my way, and
that's awesome.
I wouldn't take it back now. I'm pretty happy.
That leads us into, what's the best part of being a dad for you?
There are very few surprises whenever you get to be an adult. When you're a child, you're guided by your impulses. And then when you become an adult, you're guided by your habits. And the whole story of being an adult is trying to develop good habits to replace bad habits.
Right.
So when you have little kids, you start to see the world anew. And I know it's cliche, but to be like inspired again by a bumblebee is actually, I think, what most of us adults are lacking. It's that play, it's that curiosity and whatnot that was beat out of us through our education, through our careers and all of that. The best part about being a father is to be able to reflect every single day on the amount of love that these little girls feel for me. Like, I go away on trips for births or for whatever, and I come back and they are like, we're inseparable. And that just reminds you to just embrace this present moment right now. And that is like the ultimate sort of leveling up, I think, when you're an adult. Like, there's very little new stuff that comes your way, but you get to see the world again through child's eyes. And that keeps you young. It keeps you optimistic. I'm way more optimistic now that I have kids. And
that's awesome.
What else? What other choice do I have? I want
you have plenty of choices. But that's a good one, darling. So would you say then, the next question was, what are you best at as a dad? Do you think that's what it is that you're aware of all these things now? That because of what the world has presented, that allows you to be a better dad because you can be present with your children in the moment that they're in, because that's what's difficult for most parents.
I think the best attribute that I bring to parenting is that whatever it is that they want to do, I want that for them, because that's what I wanted for my whole life. And I didn't always get that, Dee Dee. I didn't always have people saying, hey, the way that you are is awesome. And I get to be that for them. So it's a little bit of a projection from my own traumas and whatnot. I can actually start to correct that in my own behaviors for their betterment. And I know that the reason that we're so close is because I just love the fact that they're doing that thing. It's not what I would do, but it's what they're doing. And I can love them through that. And that is probably why I'm doing such a good job. At least I think I am. I don't know.
Oh, you are. And same thing. So then that's also the same thing as, what do you think that you're best at, which I've already heard, but if you could sum it up as being a doctor, what you're doing and working with midwives and all that, that excites me. That is just incredible. So what do you feel is your best attribute that you offer as a doctor?
When we're like Dr. Paul and I, when we were both, any doctor goes through residency, you're nourished and nurtured to be a part of this bigger system. And I think what I wasn't incentivized to do was to listen to people. And I find people fascinating. I find the whole human experience to be just this ultimate curiosity. And coming into residency, I had this caricaturization of midwives as being old, dirty, lazy, stupid, whatever. And then when you actually can just say, but what if that's not true? I always like to look at things from a different perspective, the opposite person's point of view. Like, what if what I'm being told is not true? As soon as you can do that, it opens up a world of possibilities for you to care for people. So through the lens of just being curious and being willing to listen and see things from another person's point of view, it helped me understand that midwives do this so well. And then furthermore, when I work with midwives or when I work with new clients, just being able to try to empathize and to see a situation from their point of view has made me such a great physician, a great caretaker, just being present and being willing to see that this person has a whole story that precedes them. They have a whole future ahead. Where do I fit in there? I'm not the captain of this ship. How can I serve this person?
Oh my God. So you just said this. You just said something, and I want to point it out because I don't know if you realize this because you're a lot younger than I am. We have to, like with pediatricians, whenever I would get bullied and whenever Doc and I do our thing, I feel like they forget that they don't come home with us. They're not our child.
Right.
They are not allowed to make the decisions for us. So you're saying that about the birth experience and for these women who are going through these things, it's about them. It's what they want, their work. So when you say that, you're not the captain of the ship and the pediatrician is not the captain of my child's ship. So I think I love that you said that, and that is what makes you great. So,
and I actually
out of time, but I have a couple things I want to really get to. One of them is really important. I work with infants when they're first born. Babies are referred to me. Doc's been doing that for years. So my pediatric body work has to do with that birth can be traumatic. I have noticed in my practice that the most traumatic things to babies, with the spine is curved, all those different things, C-section is the worst.
Yeah.
What's funny to me is when there's an emergency birth that wasn't even planned, where there was no midwife or nothing, that in a home, those babies seem to do the best. And even in hospital births, long birth, short birth, certain things affect that baby's body and colic and all the different issues that we think children have. I think it's birth trauma.
Totally.
You see the difference in that when you're at these home births and the whole midwife thing. What do you think is the biggest difference? Is it just the light? What are they doing at home? Tell these families who think a home birth's unsafe, tell them why home is better.
That is a great question. You didn't even set me up for this one. And I have been thoughtful about this so much over the past couple months, actually. So I've started studying polyvagal theory, which is really this theory that it's not just sympathetic versus parasympathetic. You obviously know what this is about.
Oh, I'm a body worker.
So without knowing what some of this stuff seems, it seems to be confronting to what we understand about the nervous system. But if you even look at SIDS, preterm babies now have a higher chance of dying suddenly in their early years or months of life. I hadn't understood that until I started studying polyvagal. But what's, I think, most important is even if you don't have a preterm baby, the environment outside of the uterus in those weeks to months, up to 6 months, let's say, after the birth is a period during which that ventral vagal, the I am, the real full embodiment of the nervous system is starting to be entrained. And you can't do that without co-regulation with your mother. When babies are stuck away in the NICU and they're not being held, there's no mother ease, there's no laying on your bare chest and feeling the pulse. And that co-regulation is so critical to the development of your baby's nervous system and to their lifelong health. If you contrast the experience in the home where the baby is coming out, the naked little piglet is covered in goo and is wrapped up and mom is smelling you and the baby's smelling the mom and she's speaking soft, whispering, loving, caring words. And, oh, you're so sweet. Look at your little fingers. Like all of that for the next 6 months helps to develop the baby's nervous system so that we don't have a sudden collapse in the autonomic drive to stay alive. If, in contrast, that's the home environment. There's no bright lights. There's no loud noises. It's just calm and quiet, and your baby's hearing your thud on your chest, maybe even next to you in bed, like the breastfeeding, all of that. Contrast that with the bright lights, the distractions, the sharp needles, the let's put you on the warmer with the bright lights and get you dried off and do all this exams and all this stuff. If you contrast those two experiences, one is in favor of co-regulation, which is actually in support of a healthy, just blossoming little human that just came aside. The other is completely detracting from that entire experience. Mm-hmm. So that contrast alone should be enough for us to say the vast majority of births should be taking place in an environment that looks more like the home environment versus the crazy that happens in an operating room for 40% of births in the United States. Oh, we can. I'm a cusser. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. Oh, you have no idea how much I cuss, but I've been told I can't on our show. And we edit so Peter can take out a lot of this. But thank you for saying that. You and I are going to have to do another interview on this because that is my work and it's so important. And I go against what a lot of pediatricians say about having your baby on a firm surface and don't put them in bed with you and don't use something to support if they have torticollis, all those freaking things. I have one more question for you, Dr. Nathan.
Yes.
So you being an OBGYN and you said, I would like to know about both of your children's birth. So you said the second one was born at home with you. Is it just you or did you have a midwife?
Good question. Very good question, Dee Dee. When we went into our first, let me start by saying that when we had our first baby, my wife was very healthy, uncomplicated pregnancy, but she really wanted to have the baby in the hospital. And it was right before COVID happened. And it's just, that's what she wanted. So I'm always in support of wherever somebody feels called to have their baby. And we had an OBGYN there and it was a quiet room. We did our best with that. And Stephanie didn't feel great about the experience. So later, we're in the middle of COVID, we have our second baby. Now we're going to do it at home. There was the question of, do we need to hire anybody? Because it is expensive. It was like $4,500 out of pocket. And I'd just been fired for taking off my mask during COVID and caring for a dying old guy. And so we lost our health insurance. So it was like, man, do we hire somebody? Can we afford it? Like I just lost my income. What are we going to do? And at the end of the day, Stephanie in both pregnancies said, I really want for the first time in your life for you to just show up as my partner. And not be the doctor and not be the guy here to solve the problem or save the day. So it actually afforded me the opportunity to step out of the OBGYN shoes and just to be the most conscious husband and soon to be father again in our second birth. So we did have a midwife there. She brought a midwife student and she brought a doctor in the community who's getting into home birth as well. They were all there, but we were doing a type of breath work called effigy breath work. And yep. We started that an hour. It's like a somatic breath work or crampy yep. And whatnot. But Stephanie and I were laying on the bed. The tub was set up. Our breath work friend, Sarah Tremoli, came and did the breath with us an hour after Stephanie's waters opened. So an hour into actual labor. And 46 minutes into the hour-long breath session, the baby was out on her chest, like asleep. So
yeah. I knew that works.
Yeah, it works.
That is such a powerful way to have a baby.
Absolutely. So we had this team there, but they didn't have to do anything. It was literally like, okay. And had my hands not been cramped up, I probably would have caught the baby, but I could not use them.
So I have to ask, just the funny part of it was, how soon after did you go, oh my God, we didn't even need all these people stuff. We could have just done this breathing and having our baby. Now you've cost me all this money.
But an hour afterwards, I was like, God darn it. We could have. I just done it.
You're going to have your third, fourth, and fifth baby just breathing on the bed?
No, we're done having babies. Oh, we're done having babies.
I think you should have more.
I joined the Clippers. We are.
Don't you want a boy?
Situated. No, I wouldn't mind a boy, but I'm not like, let's try for another because you know what's going to happen, Dee Dee. We're going to have
six. Oh, yeah, you'll have
kids.
Two. You'll actually have
girls.
Two girls.
Yeah, right.
You'll have twins. We had a friend that just did that.
Exactly.
Shoot, yeah. they wanted a girl and they had two more boys. That cracked me up. Anyway. So yeah, I think that's important. We always wonder that for a pediatrician, are you your own kid's pediatrician or how that works? So I love that you were there and you brought up a very good point and that the fathers are very important. So I've been a birth doula and I call it professional labor support for years, doing massage through. And I always encourage the dads always seem to be the most grateful about me being there because it assisted them in being the most present they could be. I don't ever think that a doula or anyone should take over the role of the father because this birth, like you said, it's totally. These two people together making this baby happen, bringing this baby into the world. So I love that you did that. So
I mean, it's like a great opportunity. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to be that. I have to be a doctor to everybody. I can be a dad mm-hmm. for this one.
That's your role.
Easy.
So yeah, I think that's incredible. So thank you again for answering my questions. And yeah, you and I'll have to do our own show sometime.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsandscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.